Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 211 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will actually be rapid review series 32. This podcast is going to be a really short podcast, but it's going to be a really high yield podcast because it's one of those things that people tend to get wrong on exams. It's actually going to be neuro-focused, right? But I don't want people to keep making these kinds of mistakes on exams. Like, these are like 5-6 easy points on a test, right? But people tend to get this stuff wrong. So let's just get through it. And really, the focus of today's podcast is just going to be on like some common brain lesions, okay? Like some common brain lesions. Just, again, things people tend to kind of like forget after step one and not do well with when they encounter it on step two CK. Now, the thing is, if, for example, and it kind of dovetails off of some stuff I mentioned in the previous podcast, right? But I want to make it a little more comprehensive and say some more things here, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient that has trouble forming new memories? What part of the brain is all screwed up? Well, I would really hope you're telling me about the hippocampus, right? The thing is, if they don't put hippocampus, then they will likely put like temporal lobe. But in general, the hippocampus is a very important key component of the temporal lobe. So if you're having trouble with making new memories, like an anterior grade amnesia, that's a hippocampal lesion, right? And that's something that happens in the temporal lobe. And then also remember, right, if the temporal lobe doesn't work, right, the person will likely get some kind of Wernicke's aphasia, right? Wernicke's aphasia. And one thing I think I should go ahead and point out, right, like this Broca's versus Wernicke's and stuff, there's one thing your friends at the MBME love to capitalize on. People think for whatever reason that if you injure the temporal lobe on either side or the frontal lobe on either side, you can get a Broca's aphasia or Wernicke's aphasia. That is actually not true. I'll say that right now. That is not true, right? The thing is, if you have a lesion, like and it's going to be like an MCA stroke, right, on an MBME exam, because if you think about the homunculus, the middle cerebral artery covers like the Broca's and the Wernicke's area of the brain. It's actually going to be a lesion on the dominant hemisphere, right? So say, for example, you're a right-handed person. If you're a right-handed person, that means your left hemisphere is the dominant hemisphere. So when you have like a lesion, like in the left MCA, that's what will cause a Broca's aphasia and a Wernicke's aphasia. And I really hope that you understand the differences between a Broca and a Wernicke's aphasia, right? Like a Broca's aphasia is going to be like the non-fluent aphasia, right? And it's almost like the person has like a motor aphasia. And the reason it's almost like a motor aphasia is because remember that the precentral gyrus, like the Broca's area is around the precentral gyrus, Wernicke's area is around the postcentral gyrus. And remember that the precentral gyrus is motor, the postcentral gyrus is sensory, right? So the thing is, when people have a Broca's aphasia, it's a non-fluent aphasia, right? Those people also tend to have like dysarthria, and they also tend to have impaired repetition, but their comprehension is pristine, okay? And again, if they want to be like super, super, super specific, right? Like the actual part of the brain that causes Broca's aphasia is like the inferior frontal gyrus, okay? And again, remember, it's in the dominant cerebral hemisphere. So if you're a right-handed person, that's going to be your left cerebral hemisphere, right? And then Wernicke's aphasia, right, is a fluent aphasia. So these people have good speech. They're not going to have dysarthria. They're still going to have problems with repetition, right? But the thing is, their comprehension is all screwed up, okay? So this is, Wernicke's aphasia is a fluent aphasia. Broca's aphasia is a non-fluent aphasia, okay? And again, these are problems in the dominant hemisphere for that respective individual, right? And then I guess another key area where your friends at the MBME love to test this dominant versus non-dominant stuff is when you're talking about like the parietal lobe, right? So for example, what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient is neglecting one side of the world, like putting makeup on only one side of their face, they have like apraxia, like they can't tell one finger apart from the other, then what parietal lobe has been screwed up? Is it the dominant parietal lobe or the non-dominant parietal lobe? Well, I really hope you're telling me that it's the non-dominant parietal lobe. Right, so whenever you see a person have like a hemispatial neglect, that's a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion, right? But on the flip side, right, if a person has a dominant parietal lobe lesion, right, that will be, the person will have like, again, the aphasias that I've kind of talked about, like the Broca's, the Wernicke's, right? But they will also have problems like agraphia, acalculia, so they'll have trouble like doing math, you'll have trouble doing graphs, you'll have trouble writing, right? In fact, that's something that's actually known as Gerstmann syndrome, right? So Gerstmann, if I'm not mistaken, is probably a German term, but it's G-E-R-S-T-M-A-N-N, Gerstmann syndrome, okay? So again, your dominant parietal lobe will be like an essentially like a left, your left parietal lobe. So it'll be a left MCA lesion that will give rise to those problems. Your non-dominant parietal lobe, right, will be a right MCA lesion that gives rise to those kinds of problems. So please, please, please make sure that you understand exactly what I just mentioned, right? And then if a person has a cortical blindness, what part of the brain is all screwed up? Well, I would really hope you're telling me that the person will have like a lesion to the occipital lobe. Right? Basically, like the things I'm going to be talking about in this podcast are big picture things, but they are big picture things that seem to evaporate from people's minds after they take a step one, right? But they are high yield to know for step two CK and unfortunately step three, right? So the thing is, if a person has cortical blindness, because remember your primary visual cortex is in the occipital lobe, right? So if you scrub the occipital lobe, then the person is going to get into trouble with blindness, right? So, and remember also, if you have like an occipital lobe lesion, obviously you have a homonymous hemianopsia, right? You have a homonymous hemianopsia. And some of you may be wondering, Divine, what do you mean by homonymous hemianopsia? Well, homonymous hemianopsia means you lose the same visual field in both eyes, right? So it's like you're losing the right visual field in the right eye and the right visual field in the left eye, right? So whenever you have an occipital lobe lesion, basically any lesion that's distal to the optic chiasm will cause a contralateral homonymous hemianopsia. I'll say that again, will cause a contralateral homonymous hemianopsia, right? So say for example, your left occipital lobe is all screwed up. You're going to lose the right visual field in both eyes, right? So it's going to be a contralateral, right? And it's going to be a homonymous hemianopsia. Homonymous, homo means like the same, right? So if you're losing the right visual field in the right eye and the right visual field in the left eye, that's a homonymous hemianopsia, right? But think about it. If you have a lesion at the level of the optic chiasm, you have a heteronymous hemianopsia, right? What do I mean by a heteronymous hemianopsia? It means you are losing two different visual fields in both eyes, right? So for example, if you have a compression at the optic chiasm, say for example, from a prolactinoma or craniopharyngioma, the person will lose the right visual field in the right eye and the left visual field in the left eye, right? So notice it's not like we're losing the right visual field in both eyes or the left visual field in both eyes. No, we're just losing the right visual field in the right eye, the left visual field in the left eye, right? So that's what's typically known as a bitemporal hemianopsia, aka tunnel vision. Sometimes people call it, again, bilateral heteronymous hemianopsia, right? So hetero means like heterogeneous, right? So that means things are different, okay? Again, that's something you want to make sure you know for exams, right? And then if, for example, they give you a question about a patient, and this patient, which I've kind of talked about this already, right? If a patient has their eyes deviating towards the side of a lesion, right? I would hope you're telling me that that's a frontal eye field lesion. If a person has their eyes deviating away from the side, that's a cortical problem, obviously, right? If a person has the eyes deviating away from the side of the lesion, I would really hope that you're telling me that, oh, this person has a PPRF lesion, right? Like a lesion of the paramedian pontine reticular formation. And I already described the mechanisms behind that in like literally the podcast I made yesterday, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient is, you know, has like executive dysfunction, cannot balance their checks anymore. They have like contralateral, like upper motor neuron signs, right? They have like the Babinski, they have like a pronator drift, and you know, they just kind of become disinhibited and start doing like inappropriate things, right? If you see those kinds of things, what lobe of the brain is all screwed up? I really hope you're telling me that it's the frontal lobe, right? It's the frontal lobe. Remember, this is floridly high yield to know. The frontal lobe, right, controls executive function, right? It controls executive function. So when people have issues with the frontal lobe, remember, and the frontal lobe, right, is essentially like mostly motor. In fact, it's probably almost entirely like motor activity for your brain, right? So those people become disinhibited, right? They will become like apathetic. You can't get much from them, right? It's almost like having like a flat affect, right? They will have trouble like with executive tasks, right? And those people, right, like they will again begin to do things that are inappropriate. And because the corticospinal tract starts in the cortex, right, they'll have contralateral upper motor neuron symptoms, right? So like they'll have like hyperreflexia. So let's say it's like the right frontal lobe that's screwed up. They'll have like left-sided hyperreflexia. They'll have like a left positive Babinski, like an upgoing Babinski. They'll have like a pronator drift and all that stuff, right? So the thing is, You want to keep that at the back of your mind with the frontal lobe. And one thing I think I want to say with the frontal lobe is, please, do not forget that when a person has a frontal lobe problem, okay, one thing that will classically happen is they can have like reemergence of like reflexes that are lost when the person is like super, super young, right? That's one thing that can happen. And then one other high yield frontal lobe association for MBME exams is, if they give you a question about a person that has a brain tumor in the frontal lobe and it's calcified, right? And they may even tell you that, oh, they biopsy the mass and they notice that he has like a fried egg appearance on histology. If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about an oligodendroglioma. Okay, I'll say that again, an oligodendroglioma. So frontal lobe mass, it's calcified, right? On histology, he has a fried egg appearance. That's an oligodendroglioma on an MBME exam, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, just has like tremors, or they have like coriform movements, or they have, you know, they're kind of like, I would just say like, just in general, tremors. If a person has tremors, what kind of problems do you want to think about? I would really hope you're thinking about, just in general, a basal ganglia problem, okay? A basal ganglia problem when a person has a lot of tremors, right? And then if a person, for example, right, loses like all motor function on just one side of the body, it's like, you're like, man, this person's left side, like their upper and lower extremities, motor function is just completely gone. If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about a lesion to the internal capsule, more specifically the posterior limb of the internal capsule, right? The person likely has like a rupture of a perianeurism. In fact, many times it's called a Charcot-Bouchard microaneurysm, right? Usually from hypertension, right? So you have like a Charcot-Bouchard microaneurysm of the lenticulostriate artery. When that ruptures, right, you'll essentially infarct. You have a hemorrhagic infarction of the posterior limb of the internal capsule, and that can absolutely cause those things where you see like those clink cuts, right? Even like a pure sensory like stroke, right? Again, that's almost always from a problem at the level of the internal capsule, right? And again, lenticulostriate arteries. And the thing is, the biggest risk factor for that presentation is actually hypertension. That's a very common MBME exam question that you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then obviously, if a person has a lesion of the substantia nigra, right, they'll get like these Parkinsonian symptoms. And if you see like Parkinsonian symptoms in a young person on an MBME exam, you want to think about two potential pathologies, right? If it's a psych question, the person probably took like improperly cooked like heroin, right? So they have like MPTP damage of the substantia nigra. So they have like a permanent early in life Parkinsonism, right? Alternatively, and it's usually like a very sudden onset Parkinsonism, right? And then also think of Wilson's disease. When you see a person that has Parkinsonian-like symptoms and then they have like some psych issues like depression or schizophrenia-like symptoms going on. And usually they'll have like liver problems as well. Think about Wilson's disease. Remember, Wilson's disease, right? Like that copper can deposit in the basal ganglia and it can begin to cause Parkinsonian-like symptoms, right? And then obviously, if you have a question about a person that, you know, is having trouble like with being aroused, right, I would hope you're thinking more along the lines of like an issue at the level of the reticular activating system, right? Remember, it's an activating system, right? So it's something, it's actually in the midbrain, right? That's why if people have like midbrain injury, it'll be, those people essentially become comatose, right? Like it'll be very hard to kind of like rouse those people from sleep and whatnot, right? They'll just be completely comatose. And then there's this thing that most of you probably learned maybe like in med school, like your first or second year, but usually you won't even find it in like a step one resource or step two CK resource or step three resource, but they love to test this on exams, is this whole thing called like the red nucleus, right? The red nucleus. The thing is, the red nucleus, right, I think of it as like a defining part of the brain. And why do I call it a defining part of the brain? The thing is, as you study for the USMLE exams, you probably heard of these terms, the cordicate and the cerebrator posturing, right? You've probably heard of the terms, the cordicate and the cerebrate posturing. The thing is, when a person has the cerebrate posturing, it means that their problems are below the level of the red nucleus in the midbrain. Whenever you see a person have the cordicate posturing, it means that they have problems above the level of the red nucleus. And again, like I said, the red nucleus is found in the midbrain, right? Basically, When you think, and I will encourage you to probably look up pictures of this, but the corticoid posturing, essentially, it's a person that's lying completely straight, and then they have like their two fists kind of clenched towards their chests, right? I just like giving people that mental image. It's just much easier to remember than to say, this is flexed, this is extended, this, no. I'm not going to do that to you, right? So the corticoid posturing, that's a problem above the level of the red nucleus. And an easy way to remember that is the corticate, right? Your cortex is literally above the red nucleus, right? So if you have a problem above the red nucleus, that's the corticoid posturing. And again, it's a person like essentially lying straight, okay, and then their two fists are kind of clenched towards the middle of their chest, right? That's the corticoid posturing, right? Basically, your wrists, your fingers, those are flexed. Your elbows are flexed as well, right? And then your legs are kind of like extended and rotated inward. On the flip side, the cerebrate posturing is a problem below the level of the red nucleus, okay? And basically, the thing that happens with the cerebrate posturing is the person is just all stretched out, right? They're like all stretched out. Their elbows and their hands is kind of like off to the side, but their wrists are flexed, right? It's almost like having like a double waiter's tip pose, right? But everything is all extended. Elbows are extended, wrists are like everything is all extended, right? So again, I will encourage you to look up pictures of this online, right? And then, obviously, if a person has Huntington-style symptoms, you can trace that to like an atrophy of the caudic nucleus, right? If a person has like, they tell you that, oh, this person has lost all motor function, right? The only thing the person can do is to like wink their eyes, right? You want to think about like locked-in syndrome under those circumstances. Remember, there are two things that can cause locked-in syndrome on NBME exams, right? You can get a vascular cause of locked-in syndrome if, for example, a person has like a basilar artery stroke. Alternatively, you can also get like central pontine myelinolysis. Remember, the name has recently been changed to osmotic demyelination syndrome, where you fix hyponatremia too quickly, right? Remember the mnemonic that from low to high, a person's pons will die, and from high to low, the person's brains will blow, right? So when you fix hyponatremia too quickly, you can get osmotic demyelination syndrome. If you fix hypernatremia too quickly, you can get cerebral edema. Also, that same rule also applies to hyperglycemia. So if they give you a question about a person that has like DKA or HHNS, and then the person suddenly becomes comatose, right? If you see that kind of stuff on an NBME exam, then you definitely want to think about, the person getting cerebral edema from fixing their hyperglycemia, like just a little too quickly, right? And then remember, if a person has, they tell you that a person has like vertical diplopia, right? So like when they are walking up and downstairs, they have like double vision, or, you know, basically like they see double in a vertical direction. You want to think about pyrenoid syndrome. That's almost always from a pineoloma on an NBME exam, right? Remember, the pineal gland is superior to the superior colliculus, right? So if you have a pineoloma, that can compress the superior colliculus and cause a vertical diplopia. And then don't forget, right, if a person has like a lesion of the cerebellar vermis, so say for example from like a medulloblastoma or a pilocytic astrocytoma or from a hemangioblastoma, right, those people have like, you know, like truncal ataxia, right? So they will have like ataxia like almost like in the middle of the body. Contrast that with people that have like a cerebellar hemisphere lesion, right, where they'll have like, you know, like more of like the intention tremors, but they'll have more like limb ataxia. And the thing is, the limb ataxia is going to be ipsilateral to the lesion. I'll say that again, it's going to be ipsilateral to the lesion. The thing is, there are actually some decussations that happen, but it's actually two decussations. But the thing is, that is beyond the scope of, if you're interested in that, you can email me, I can explain. But that's beyond the scope of this discussion. But basically, whenever you have a cerebellar lesion, you'll have like ipsilateral limb ataxia, right? And then if they tell you that, oh, a person has like flailing movements of one arm, you want to think about like something called a hemibolismus, right? It's usually contralateral to the lesion, right? So if you have like a left subthalamic nucleus lesion, you have like contralateral hemibolismus. So, and also don't forget, right, like the most, if a person has like a non-communicating hydrocephalus, aka obstructive hydrocephalus, and they ask you like what's the most common location in the ventricular system to give rise to those troubles, you absolutely want to think about the cerebral aqueduct of Sylvius, right? Remember, that's in the midbrain. And then if a person has a communicating hydrocephalus, right, you want to think more about a problem at the level of the arachnoid granulations, right, where CSF is like reabsorbed into the superior sagittal sinus. That's almost always like normal pressure hydrocephalus on an NBME exam, or from like meningitis or like a malignancy that's growing at the level of those arachnoid granulations, right? And then don't forget that if a person has schizophrenia, right, they tend to have like enlargement of the lateral ventricles. If a person has Alzheimer's, right, they'll have like dysfunction of the basal nucleus just of minors, right? If a person has Alzheimer's, right, they can also have like dysfunction of the enzyme choline acetyltransferase or CHAT, right? So again, these are just all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. They are basically this podcast, I just wanted to focus mainly on like neuroanatomical associations that are very high yield and very commonly tested on the USMLEs. And as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the ABIM board exam and the internal medicine in training exam. And also if you're a college student that needs tutoring for like the MCAT, right? For like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those subjects. And I also do these booster courses for the USMLEs, right? So it's like 15 hours for step 2 CK and step 3. It's like 20 hours for step 1. Again, the vast majority of people I've done this with, they've found it to be like super, super, super helpful. Basically, in those courses, it's one-on-one. I review like the high-yield things that you need to know for each and every exam. And again, many people have found that to be super, super helpful. And they were like, Divine, I got a lot of questions right on my exam because of this little time we spent together one-on-one kind of reviewing the most notes. It's rapid fire and it's Q&A, but again, it's very effective. And then there's this online private study group thing that, again, I'll likely be studying in a few days. Basically, it will just be like a group of like, you know, a bunch of people, like maybe like just some number in like the low tens of people, right? Where it will probably be over Zoom, right? And we'll have like a theme, like a cardiology theme or an endocrinology theme for like either step one or 2CK or even 2CS or step three. We'll review those things, right? In a very quick, succinct, high-yield fashion. I will also give people the opportunity to answer questions. Each person will just pay a nominal fee, right? So just look out for more details on that. If you're interested, reach out to me through the website, or you can send me an email, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And then another thing I want to say is if you're like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one, I guess I can call it like coaching, or you can maybe call it consulting, where like I work with you on like editing your personal statements, editing your applications, doing mock interviews, rec letters, stuff like that. Again, the vast majority of people I've worked with have pretty much all matched their first choices. And again, I also have like admissions committee experience at a top 2 med school for a year, right? So again, I have a ton of experience reviewing people's applications. So if this is something you're interested in, just reach out to me and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.